is going to be on experimental studies that we've been doing on the folding pathway of proteins, and then more recently on the assembly of much larger protein-protein complexes. So what I'm going to do is basically break the talk down into three sections, and the first two sections are going to be on two detailed studies on the folding pathways of two proteins, two quite small, relatively simple proteins in terms of their folding pathways. And then at the end, if I have time, what I'd really like to do is include a section on some very recent work that we've been doing, which is much more biological in nature, looking at how large molecular complexes assemble in the cell and what's involved in terms of unfolding and refolding of the proteins to get those complexes to form. Okay, so I'm glad that I'm kind of giving a talk towards the end of the week, and several other people earlier on in this week have given quite nice introductions to protein folding problem. So I'm not going to go into too many details about the exact nature of that problem, because you've already heard it. But I'd like to stress one thing, and it includes me, that we all used to have the idea that all that was happening in the cell was that the cell was synthesizing some unfolded, highly flexible polypeptide chain, and then that was folding spontaneously to form some compact, unique three-dimensional structure, and that was the active form of the protein. Now, in many cases, that is true. However, there are a large number of cases where actually the protein isn't active in a simple monomeric folded state, and that in order to be active, it has to go on and assemble with a large number of either other proteins or other cofactors. So the example I've given to illustrate this is the first of all, the folding of one of the proteins involved in the 30S ribosomal unit, and that's just the ribosomal protein F8, which is about 14 kilodaltons in size. And this is inactive in this state, and it has to assemble with a large number of other proteins and also RNA in order to make an active ribosomal complex in order to synthesize polypeptide chains. So I think for a large number of years, the idea was that what was happening in the cell was one protein was being synthesized, another protein was being synthesized, and then they were just spontaneously coming together and binding, and that there weren't any other things that were involved in this process. But more recently, it's been established that actually, in a large number of cases, this type of process isn't a spontaneous one, and it actually requires a large number of cofactors, and in particular, proteins that aid in the folding and unfolding of other proteins. So I'll probably only talk about this bit for about the last 10-15 minutes, and I'll concentrate mainly today on this first particular area. Okay, so what I really want to do today is get across to you as theoretical physicists what we measure experimentally and how we interpret that data, and perhaps a little bit on what we can't measure experimentally, and also kind of on the limitations of our experimental techniques. So I'm not going to go into any details of experimental methods, but if anybody is interested, I'm happy to talk to them after the talk about how we actually perform these measurements in the lab. So the first system I'm going to be talking about is some folding studies that have been going in my lab for about the last 3 or 4 years on a protein called FKBP12. Now, we need to know nothing about what this protein does in the cell or why it's called FKBP12. We do need to know a little bit about the structure, which I've shown here in this simplified ribbon diagram. And even people who are used to looking at proteins all the time sometimes find themselves getting lost as they're trying to trace the chain. So the structure is frequently represented, is frequently coloured such that the colour goes from dark blue at the end terminus through the chain, and as the colour changes, we end up with red at the C terminus. So that makes it a little bit easier to kind of trace the chain topology. And that's the kind of representation I'm going to use throughout the talk, bar one overhead, which is going to change. Okay, so here we have a relatively small protein. It's 107 amino acids in length, and it's a single domain protein, and it has an anti-parallel beta sheet formed by these five strands. So that's strand 1, 2, 3, the helix, strand 4, then a very extended loop, and strand 5. And the hydrophobic core is formed by the packing of the alpha helix against this anti-parallel beta sheet. So what we can do in the lab is we can unfold the protein and we can refold the protein, and we can measure the rate constant associated with that process. And one thing I should stress is that experimentally what we observe in this particular system is only the unfolded state or the folded state. So what we're measuring is the rate constant from the unfolded state to the folded state, or the rate constant from the folded state to the unfolded state. And empirically we find that as we measure the rate constant as a function of our concentration of denaturant, so the method in which we use primarily to unfold and refold proteins is by using high concentrations of some chemical denaturant. In this case it's urea, in other cases it'll be guanidinium chloride or guanidinium thiocyanate. So in fact, if we make these measurements, what we find is that we get a very nice linear relationship between the logarithm of the rate constant for either unfolding or folding against the concentration of denaturant. So on this side of this chevron plot, at high concentrations of denaturant, we're measuring the protein unfolding. So now as we increase the concentration of denaturant, the protein unfolds more rapidly. And on this half of the chevron plot, at lower concentrations of denaturant, we're measuring the folding rate constant, and you can see that the folding rate constant increases as we decrease the denaturant concentration. So if you go and... Yes?
How do we measure the rate?
I didn't want to go into many experimental details, but there's a large fluorescence change between the unfolded state and the folded state. And essentially what we do is we do a rapid mixing experiment where we either take our folded protein and rapidly mix it in large concentrations of chemical denaturant to make it unfold, or we unfold our protein and then dilute out the denaturant very rapidly. So for many proteins, not all proteins, but for many proteins, we can do these rapid mixing experiments. The mixing using stop flow techniques, and the mixing occurs in roughly about between 2 and 5 milliseconds. And for a lot of proteins, the rate of folding and unfolding is such that this is a perfectly suitable technique. But of course, we're then not observing anything that's happening in within those first 2 milliseconds.
Is all the structure gone in the unfolded state, or is the alpha helix maybe still there? Or
can I? I'm going to come to that. Unfolded? It's largely unfolded.
Largely
unfolded. You find that there are transient, in the unfolded state, there's transient formation of secondary structure. And the amount of formation of this, what's termed residual structure.
They are two different physical entities on one and the same curve.
Sorry?
There are two different entities, Kf and Ku, and you joined the curves. Why is that?
Why?
Two different curves here.
There are. There are, but they're related. If you think of the equilibrium between these two states, right? Then the equilibrium constant for this process is just given by Kf divided by Ku.
What is being plotted?
What is being here in this slide?
What is being plotted in this V-shaped?
It's the logarithm of the rate constant for either unfolding or folding.
Sophie's jumping from one set of equilibrium conditions to another, watching the rate at which a new equilibrium is achieved. And both a folding and an unfolding rate are in that. On the left hand side, the refolding rate dominates. On the right hand side, the unfolding rate dominates. But at every point, there's some combination of both, and the curve she fit to has both.
I mean, as you're changing the concentration of, as you're changing the,
then one dominates. That is the answer. Then I have no question.
Right. Yes, and as you're changing the chemical, as you're changing the concentration of chemical denaturant, you're changing the relative energy levels between.
You got the answer.
Right. Okay.
So,
per second. Yeah. In this case. So these kind of chevron or V-shaped curves have now been observed for many, many small proteins. And if you go to any experimental papers, you'll frequently see them. And this is very symptomatic of this perfect V-shaped curve. It's very symptomatic of a system which is basically following the two-state model, in that all we're ever observing is either the unfolded state or the folded state. Now, I should probably make a point here, which is that there may be other states on the pathway, but energetically they must be high in energy because we're not observing them kinetically. So just because this follows this kind of two-state model doesn't necessarily mean that there aren't other structured states along the pathway, because there are. But we can't detect them. Although I'll come...
That may have some importance for the dynamics field.
Yes.
So it may be a complex dynamics. And that's the scheme of a simple dynamics.
Yes, yeah. So experimentally, this is the kind of model we use, because it fits the data perfectly.
You could show maybe something like the picking of the exponential.
It
looks like an exponential.
You mean each? I mean, if you take each individual point here and you look at the raw data and you're fitting it to an exponential,
each
it fits. At each point, you're doing a different experiment at a different concentration of denaturant, and you're looking at an exponential change in the signal, and it fits very well to an exponential.
Yeah, I'm asking how well it's very well.
How well is very well? It within error. I mean, there are other complicating factors which I'm not going to go into as to why sometimes you see multiple exponentials. Sorry? Yes. That's because, and I didn't really want to get into that. That's because the unfolding is a perfect single exponential, and the refolding isn't. It's actually multi-exponential. But it's multi-exponential for the fact that you have heterogeneity in the unfolded state due to the isomerization of proline peptide bonds, and it's nothing to do with folding. But it just makes the data it makes refolding data sometimes, if the phases get close, it makes it a little bit more difficult to analyze. So generally you have a bit more scatter, and in particular in this, I think with the other protein I'll talk about, there's hardly any scatter. But with this particular protein, this is a bit more of an issue, because this actually the rates of folding of this protein aren't that fast. This is a half-life of folding of about 200 milliseconds. So compared to the kind of rates that Bill Eaton was talking about on Tuesday, this is actually quite slow. And compared even to the rates of folding of quite a lot of other proteins, it's quite slow. And I'll get on to the reasons why that might be later on. Sorry, this.
When you measure time of refolding.
Yes.
This is for slow pains or for slow cracking or fast cracking or just there.
Okay, I think I'll just quickly do an overhead. Okay, so if we take the folded states of proteins, then there will be a number, there will probably, for many proteins, be a number of proline bonds. So almost all peptide bonds are in the trans configuration. Apart from proline, so essentially for all of the other 19 amino acids, you get, say, 99.9% trans, 1%, 0.1% cis, or even less than that. But for prolines, because essentially they have this cyclic structure, so they don't just have, so this is the C alpha group, they don't just simply have a side chain coming out here, that the side chain, if you like, comes back and covalently bonds with the backbone nitrogen. What that means is the energy difference between the cis and the trans form is much less here than in here, which means that if you don't have any constraints on that bond, i.e. structure, you have an equilibrium between the trans form and the cis form, which is what happens in the unfolded state. But in the folded state, you have the rest of the structure of the protein, which is essentially fixing that bond in one particular conformation, and it's frequently trans. So if we have a folded state of a protein which has one proline in it, and it's in the trans conformation, then when we initially unfold that protein, we'll get an unfolded state which also has the proline still in the trans conformation. But now if we leave that, we'll set up an equilibrium in which that proline bond isomerizes to the cis conformation, and that process is slow. So now if we take are unfolded. So when we're looking at unfolding, we just see a single exponential. But now when we refold that, we've got this heterogeneous population. So now what happens is the, and let's say it's about 90% and 10%, which is roughly what we observe. So now what happens is the unfolded protein that has the proline in the native-like trans conformation can fold rapidly. But now the molecules in the unfolded state which have the proline in the cis conformation have to undergo a slow isomerization of that bond. So essentially they have to go back to the trans form before they can then fold. So what you observe is you observe 90% of your signal, which has got a very fast rate, and a much weaker, a much smaller signal corresponding to the slow isomerization. Now, if this is, so if these two rates are very different, then it's very easy to fit the data. And you can get very nice refolding data, and you'll see that for the second protein I'm going to talk about, which folds faster than this protein. But with this protein, because this protein is actually folding quite slowly, the rates actually are not as large a difference between them. So it just means that the errors are slightly larger.
But the question is that in this particular case, you take what amounts to an average time constant, it mixes together the two, and that's the answer to this question.
No, you're not. No, because you can separate. You can separate them still. So what you see is you see some fast phase, and then you'll see a much slower phase. And you're fitting to a double
Which one is in the curve?
The fast phase. Because the fast phase is corresponding to the folding of the protein, whereas the slow phase is corresponding to a proline isomerization event. So we don't quite throw it out, but we fit it, but then only take the rate constant for the fast phase.
Maybe right.
Yes.
2 hours. 3 hours.
Oops. I blanked it. That's right. Right. Okay. So just to kind of go over some of the terminology we use, which I'm sure you've been introduced to earlier on this week. So, and some of the ways in which we kind of represent folding pathways. So, like I've said, for many small proteins, all we observe experimentally is a two-state system. And we don't observe any intermediate states, although they may be present. And we just represent this very simplistically in two dimensions with a free energy diagram here, where we have the unfolded state, transition state, and a folded state. And of course, if one wants to think in terms of energy landscapes and funnels, that corresponds to a very smooth funnel like this, which I'm sure Ken went over on Monday. And what I'm going to argue is it doesn't matter whether we want to take this view of folding or this view of folding. The information you're getting out of these experiments is the same. So I'm also going to be talking about three-state systems in which we do detect what I will call an intermediate state. So here now we have some other state, and again here I've just used a very simplistic representation of the free energy where the intermediate is on pathway to the folded state. And now the intermediate is lower in energy than the unfolded state, so we can observe it kinetically. And essentially what happens is that as this energy comes down relative to the unfolded state, then the energy, the activation energy here increases, and we start to see a rate which is slower than we would expect if we had just a simple two-state system. So now if I go back, because I'm going to show quite a few chevron plots. So this is very typical of a two-state system. So in a three-state system, what we'd see is the unfolding would be the same. And then as we got to lower and lower concentrations of denaturant, which effectively favor structured states, then we start to see some deviation from linearity, some rollover in the plot. And the rate that we measure in the absence of denaturant is now significantly lower than the rate that we would expect if it was just following the simple two-state model. So a bit later you're going to see a number of plots where some of them are this perfect V-shape and some of them show this rollover. Okay, so as many systems follow this two-state model, what we're interested in doing, really, is we can obviously characterize the folded state by NMR crystallography. We can, in fact, characterize the unfolded state using NMR techniques, also some other techniques. But what we're interested in doing, really, is characterizing this transition state. So what we want to know is what the transitions, what the structure and the energetics of the transition state look like. So there are a number of different ways of doing that. There's a couple of different experimental approaches that are used. The only approach that I'm going to talk about today, although we have used these other approaches, is an approach using protein engineering methods and something called five-value analysis. These other, what I've termed non-mutagenic approaches, so not using protein engineering, give you some information, but they give you very crude information compared to the protein engineering experiments. So I'm just going to concentrate on what information we can get out of these types of experiments. And then computationally, there's a variety of approaches used, molecular dynamic approaches, which I'm going to mention very briefly, and lattice simulations, which I'm not really going to make reference to at all, because I think a number of other people have talked about those in detail. Okay, so the protein engineering method and the five-value analysis. So, first of all, I just want to kind of define what I mean by protein engineering. So these days, it's actually very straightforward. My students would argue it's not very straightforward, but it's very straightforward to take a protein and to take one specific residue in that protein. And the example I've got here is a valine residue at position 101 in this protein, and change it to any other amino acid. And that's essentially just the protein engineering technique. So what we do is we identify positions and side chains that we're interested in, which we think may be important for folding. And normally what we do is we, in fact, delete part of the side chain. So what we're doing is we're removing interactions without introducing new interactions. So here what we've done is just change a valine, and you can see the side chain here, into an alanine. So we've just removed two methyl groups, two CH3 groups. And again, I just wanted to give you, as this is going on the web, the nomenclature. So when we take this, so this is termed our wild-type protein with a valine at position 101. After the engineering, we have a mutant protein which has an alanine at position 101, and the nomenclature for that new mutant protein is different from different groups. So it's either one of these three, VA101, V101A, VAL101, ALA. So then what we do is we measure the effect of this mutation on the different on the different energy levels in our diagram, and using equilibrium experiments, we can. So most of the mutations, we're removing interactions, so we're destabilizing the folded state of the protein. So we're increasing the energy of the folded state. We're not really affecting the energy of the unfolded state. So we can measure just from an equilibrium experiment. We can measure this energy difference here, and using our kinetic experiments, we can measure this energy difference here. And we define a phi value, and the phi value is just simply the ratio of this energy difference here to this energy difference here. So now you can imagine some limiting cases, and the first case is when our phi value is zero. So essentially here what we're saying is this energy difference here must be zero. So what we're saying is we've made a mutation. It's affected the stability of the folded state of the protein, but it's had no effect on the transition state. So it's had no effect on the kinetics of, in fact, on the kinetics of folding. So essentially what we can say is that this particular mutation must be in a region of the protein that's not really highly structured in the transition state. Because we're making a mutation which we know affects the energy of the folded state, but it's having no effect on the kinetics of folding.
When you say that the phi can be small either because the numerator is small or because the denominator is large?
Okay, experimentally, in order to be able to get accurate phi values, if this is too small, then the errors just become too large. So you can only look at mutations which have had a significant effect on the energy levels. So in fact, we don't ever look at mutations which have had a very small effect on.
Could it become larger than one?
Sorry?
Could it become greater than one?
It can, and there are reasons why it might. But I would say 99% of the mutations we make, they're between 0 and 1. Okay, so conversely, we can make a mutation in which we get a phi value of 1. So essentially what we're saying is this mutation has had the same effect energetically on the transition state as it's had on the folded state. And this suggests that actually it has to be in a region which is structured in the transition state, so that it's in a region in which it's making favorable interactions in the transition state. Then of course we have values between 0 and 1, which depending on the nature of the substitution you make, indicate that there's some partial structure formation in the transition state. So if we do this, and we make a
Can you slow down a bit?
Yes. Yes.
For each, so you take a particular residue, 101, whatever, you mutate it into something else.
Yes.
So phi value may depend on what you mutate it into.
Okay, so normally.
Take some averages or you just do one?
So normally, what we really want to do is make what we call non-disruptive deletions. So what we want to do is, ideally what we want to do is we want to remove a specific interaction and ask is that interaction important in terms of the folding kinetics? Is that interaction present in the transition state or not? So what we do is we take a very conservative set of substitutions. Because if you remove some interactions and then introduce new interactions, the interpretation of the results is much more difficult. So in general, you'll see in a lot of papers that the side chains are mutated to alanine, which has just a single methyl group as a side chain, which is considered to be a quite neutral side chain, in that most side chains apart from glycine have a C beta. Well, all side chains apart from glycine have a C beta atom. So that we're removing things without, we're removing interactions without introducing new interactions. So you very rarely see kind of people substitute every single amino acid at a particular point. The other thing is that a lot of the mutations that we're doing are in the core, and you don't want to stick a positively charged residue in the core because your protein will never fold. So there are a lot of mutations that are to alanine. However, what we can do is, like, if we've got a large hydrophobic side chain, we can mutate it to several different amino acids and effectively truncate it in bits. And then what we do is we have then a series of phi values at the same position. And in fact, if you do that, I can't show you any data, you'll just have to believe me. So, for example, if you take the simplest example is to take an isoleucine side chain, which has that structure. First of all, mutate it into a valine side chain, so you're just removing one methyl group. And then, somebody should have told me to. and then mutate it again to an alanine. So in fact, what we get is what we're doing is mutating it from the wild type to an alanine. So we can calculate a phi for this, a phi for this, and a phi for this. And what we see is that actually, for a single position, the phis are all within experimental error.
What is really the advantage of the phi over the delta G itself? I mean, why don't you take the delta G of the transition state itself?
Because what we're really interested in is the fraction of interactions that are formed. So if you take, turned it off again. So what you're saying, why don't you just take this value here? Well, that value there is going to be very dependent on the mutation, not just on the position. So if you make a very large mutation in which you're removing lots of interactions, then what you're doing is you're probably going to have a much larger effect both on the folded state and on the transition state. So what we want to ask is not what the overall effect is. We want to say what fraction of the interactions that this residue is making in the folded state is it making in the transition state. It's like kind of normalizing it so that we can look at all positions and all substitutions and compare them. If you just use this value, it would be very difficult to compare different mutations and different positions. Whereas as we're taking the ratio, effectively we're normalizing so we can compare.
I think there's an important point to make in that the way Sophie does these experiments and thinks about these experiments is done the way it should be done. What you'll see in the literature is you'll see phi values and you'll see theorists calculating phi values, but these phi values are sort of irrelevant because they might have substituted a positive charge or a negative charge. So one has to be very careful in looking at phi values reported in the literature and trying to come up with some theoretical explanation. The ideal experiment would be if we could do something like an isotope effect where there's no assumptions then about changing the structure. Here the structure could collapse a little bit, make a hole by removing a methyl group, could rearrange the structure. The idea is to keep the identical structure. The problem is that the equilibrium constant cannot be measured with such high precision. You could imagine possibly doing a kinetic experiment and being able to see an isotope effect, but you can't make the equilibrium measure. Mm-hmm. So this is the next best thing.
So effectively what we're doing, you can view it as a kind of perturbation method. We're perturbing the system and then looking at the effect of that perturbation on the rates of folding and unfolding. But we don't want to perturb the system too much. So we're just trying to perturb the system as much as we need to experimentally measure all the values without perturbing it too much. And the other thing which I'm frequently asked about, and this comes to the point that Bill made, is that in this analysis here, particularly when it comes to partial phi values, and you'll see soon that in fact you mainly get partial phi values, that you're assuming that you're not affecting the energy of the unfolded state. Now you have to be really careful about this, and lots of experimentalists aren't. So if you make that, I can tell now that you're never going to read an experimental paper ever again. But having said that, if you make a mutation where you say take a charged residue and mutate it to a non-charged residue, then you're changing the solvation energy quite significantly. So in fact, you're changing the energy in the unfolded state as well as changing the energy in the transition state and the folded state. And then the analysis gets very difficult for fractional phi values. But if you make a substitution, all the substitutions I'm going to show you are substituting one hydrophobic residue for another slightly smaller hydrophobic residue, and there effectively doesn't it? It is. I'm told I've got to be recorded. so I'll put it back on. So in that case, when you're looking at a hydrophobic substitution to a slightly smaller hydrophobic substitution, the solvation energies of the two side chains in the unfolded state are very, very similar. We're assuming, and there's a lot of evidence to support this assumption, that we're also not affecting the structure of the folded state.
From a kineticist point of view, if you have phi of zero, it means that the rate of folding doesn't change.
Yes.
And the entire contribution to the change of delta G is by way of the rate of unfolding.
Exactly, yes.
And the other way around, if phi is equal to 1, why do you call it structured and not structured?
Okay, so what we're doing, of course, is we're measuring energy differences, but what we're really interested in is structure. So what we're saying is that if this energy difference is the same as this energy difference, then the site of mutation, which is responsible for this energy difference, has got to be making as many interactions in the transition state as it's making in the folded state. Therefore, it's got to be in a region which is structured.
It's come from standard linear free energy relation,
exactly.
Physical organic chemistry.
Yeah, I was
and basically, it's an extra thermodynamic relation that says that if the phi is 1, then the thermodynamic properties of the transition state are identical to the thermodynamic properties of the native state. And the inference from that is that the structure of that region is
it's the same.
Because it has to be, you could accidentally have the same free energy.
Yes. I mean, you could have like non-native interactions such that in the transition state, you were still forming as many interactions, but they weren't native-like. But without going into a whole range of other experiments involving double mutant cycles, you just have to accept that there's no evidence to suggest that. So the evidence suggests that the interactions that that we're affecting in the transition state are native-like interactions. Okay, so I've gone through phases where I've got terribly worried about all these assumptions that are in the method. And then what happens is if you make sufficient enough mutations, and this perhaps is another thing to stress, is that I think you really do, although it's a lot of work, you really do need to make 20, 30 mutations to begin to get a coherent picture of what the transition state may look like, or the transition state ensemble. And in fact, if you do so, you get what I think is a wonderfully kind of consistent pattern of phi values. So these are the results of about 35 mutations on FKBP12, kind of scattered throughout all the elements of structure. And I've just color-coded this so that the residues which have very low phi values are shown in blue, and then gradually as you increase the phi value, you go through green, yellow, orange, and then the highest residues with the highest phi values are colored in red. And hopefully what you can see is there's quite a consistent pattern. So these regions up here, which have blue and green colors, are very unstructured in the transition state. And this is this very long loop here, and also the edge, it's a bit difficult to follow the structure, the edge strand here, and also the N-terminal part of the helix. So the helix is here, lying across the beta sheet. And as you progress from the C terminus of the helix, which has a reasonably high phi value because it's making tertiary interactions with the strands of the sheet, which are also structured, if you go up the helix, you get a wonderful kind of gradation of phi values. So you go from 0.6 down to 0. So you go 0.6, 0.3, 0.1, 0. Oh, so this is the native state, yeah, with the phi values superimposed on them. And you'll see that this edge strand here is also only got very small amounts of structure in the transition state. So we really have a kind of cluster of residues which have phi values, which have quite high phi values. So one thing I should say is that with this protein and also a lot of other small proteins, that frequently you don't get any phi values of one. So you don't have any residue which is making all of its native-like interactions. So the most it's making in this case is about, energetically, about 60%. So they're all clustered in this region here, and this region here is the fourth and the fifth beta strand, part of the second beta strand, and the C-terminal part of the helix. And I've just got, so this is just the same data with the protein rotated, so you get a different view. So this is now the helix here, and this is the core. So we have this region in the core here, which seems to be the most structured in the transition state, and a lot of the rest of the structure is really not present to any great extent. So I said that this protein folded slowly, and I think these phi values maybe give us some indication of why that this protein folds quite slowly compared to other proteins. And that's because if you look at the, I'll just go back, if you look at the structure, now the regions of the protein that are forming, if you like, a kind of folding nucleus, are actually very distant in terms of their primary amino acid sequence. So although you have interactions formed between beta strand 4 and beta strand 5, between these two strands there's this very, very extended loop. So in order to get those strands together, you can imagine is entropically very unfavorable. And also the tertiary interactions that are made between beta strands 4 and 5 and the alpha helix are also quite distant in terms of primary amino acid sequence.
Can you start to do the residues at the same time?
Yeah, you can take what that includes, this data all includes kind of multiple mutations at some positions, and if you get a phi value of, you get... Oh, double mutants. We haven't done any double mutants for this particular protein. But if you do double mutants and you measure the interaction energy between the two residues, and you measure that interaction energy in the transition state and the folded state, and you get a phi value based on that interaction energy, then it'll have the same phi value for the proteins in which it's been done. It'll have the same phi value as the individual single mutations. So again, that suggests that the interactions that are made in the transition state are native-like. And the thing is experimentally, it's extremely difficult to do that because you're making two mutants, both of which destabilize the protein, so your double mutant is going to be very destabilized. So you need to start out with a very stable protein to begin with. So although we haven't done it for this protein, it's been done for other proteins. And
so the transition state
leads
to coincide
with what we call? It's a bit variable, so I think that Jose talked a little bit yesterday about SH3 domains. So here you have what I would say is quite, if you like, an extended region where you're forming some kind of folding nucleus, if you like, whereas with other proteins, so with some proteins it's more extended and in other proteins it's more localized, and that seems to be dependent on structure. So with SH3 domains it seems to be much more, if you like, localized to this distal beta hairpin and the packing of the distal beta hairpin against, I've forgotten what it's, the diverging turn, I think. So it depends a bit. It depends a little bit on the structure. But there's still probably only 10 proteins for which this has been done in sufficient detail that I think you really have an accurate picture of what's going on. And for a lot of small proteins, it's primarily the hydrophobic core. But in fact, it's a bit difficult to tell, but there's actually a whole region of the core up here, and this region doesn't appear to be that highly structured. So it doesn't appear to be just a general hydrophobic, non-specific hydrophobic collapse. Okay, so once we've got that, so that's the kind of information that we can get out of experimental studies. And what I wanted to do now is just say that once you've got that quite detailed information, what you can begin to do with it. So you can begin to address a number of different questions that have been posed, and one of which comes down to the fact that although we used to think of the unfolded, the denatured state of proteins as being a complete random coil with no structural preference whatsoever, it's clear that in some cases there is transient formation of secondary structure in certain regions of the unfolded state. And one idea was that this residual structure could really act as a kind of nucleation point for folding. Now, we were fortunate for this protein that another group had already looked at this residual structure in the unfolded state, so we didn't have to spend hours on the NMR doing it. And this slide just illustrates our phi values relative to what's known about the residual structure. And basically, what we wanted to ask was, are the regions which are involved in residual structure also present in the transition state, which is what you'd expect? So here, what I've shown on this side is a representation of the regions of residual structure. So light blue is no structure whatsoever. Orange is a very small amount, and we're really talking about very, very small amounts of transiently formed structure. And then the red indicates those regions that form most residual structure in the unfolded state.
So what does most mean in a quantitative sense? Is the free energy negative, or is it still positive?
Well, I mean, these things, so in all of the NMR experiments, the only probe they have, the only indication they have of this residual structure is NOEs. Because everything else, like chemical shifts and things, looks like it's random coil. But because NOEs are very, very sensitive to distance, even if two groups are only near each other spatially, you know, a very small amount of the time, you'll still see a weak NOE.
The suggestion that these structures
even still have relatively negative positive field. Yes. Yeah. So the NOEs are the only way in which you can detect them, at least for FKBP12. I mean, I think with other cases where there's more significant residual structure, you might be able to detect them using chemical shift and coupling constants and things, but not in this case.
I presume that you are talking about averages over all that.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yes.
But the single molecules, we don't know, of course, how they fluctuate.
Absolutely not. We're talking about a large ensemble of rapidly interconverting conformations. And what we're saying is on average, there is some slight bias in certain regions of the protein to form very, very unstable, transiently formed secondary structure.
So the question.
So I think this representation is a bit misleading. We're not saying that kind of very small sheet around there is formed. We're just saying that there are some interactions between here and here, and some interactions between here and here some interactions between here and here, and some interactions within this loop. So, and one thing...
Any non-beta NOEs?
Pardon?
Any non-beta NOEs picked up?
No. But interestingly, the NOEs they pick up are different in urea and guanidinium, which, again, so they depend a little bit on how you're unfolding your protein. And again, if you unfold your protein using like low pH or high temperature, you might see a slightly different set of NOEs and residual structure.
Do you see evidence of residual structures which are
non-NOE? No, not in this particular protein. Okay, so...
So
right, okay. I don't mind. Well, we're not that far through. Yeah, that's fine. That's fine with me. I can take a break too. Okay, so I hope at this point everyone's now clear on how phi values are calculated and how they're interpreted. If not, I think I'm quite happy to talk to people later. Okay, so once we've made enough mutations and we've measured enough phi values, we really do get a very detailed picture now of not only the energetics in the transition state, but therefore some information about the structure which we infer from the energetics, and we can begin to address a number of different questions. So as I said, there is some residual structure in the unfolded state of FKBP12 as determined by NMR, and it may not be that easy to see, but they found quite a lot of residual structure in the N-terminal region of the helix. Now, this is a region which, again, it's a bit difficult to see. It's this region here, and it's a region which we find is completely unstructured in the transition state. And hopefully what you'll be able to see is that they find residual structure in areas of the protein which we find to be highly unstructured in the transition state. So at least for FKBP12, we believe that the small amount of residual that's seen in the unfolded state is not affecting folding at all. And when I get onto the second protein, which I can go through much faster, now we've sorted out phi values, you'll see that actually what we see is exactly the opposite. Okay, so we were also interested in this idea of whether evolution had so what we term this kind of cluster of residues which are forming a structured region in the transition state, the folding nucleus. And the model in which we use is a nucleation condensation mechanism. So what we're saying is that once these residues have come together, then effectively we're at the top of the free energy barrier, and folding is then a completely downhill process in which we just have a very rapid condensation of all the other residues around that nucleus. And that nucleus might be quite extended. So there had been some suggestion that evolution would want to conserve folding nuclei in order to maintain rapidly folding proteins. So of course, if you disrupt interactions in this region, you're affecting the rate of folding quite significantly. If you disrupt interactions elsewhere in the protein, you might be disrupting the stability of the protein, but you're not affecting the folding rate. So we wanted to address this question, so we looked at the sequence conservation of this family of proteins. I can't remember how many, we did 200 plus members of the family, and this just illustrates the conservation. So those highly conserved residues are shown in red, and those residues, the light blue is just residues where we have no phi values, so they're just neutral. And then we have this right down to white, which in which there's effectively no sequence conservation at those positions. And this isn't the best of illustrations, but effectively we see no correlation whatsoever between the conservation of amino acids and the folding nucleus. This is the region which is most highly conserved, and this is a region actually, of course, that's the active region in terms of the function of the protein. So even if we kind of ignore that, which obviously has a very high evolutionary pressure on it for function, that we still see very, very little conservation at all. And residues which we know are the most important in terms of stabilizing the transition state are no more highly conserved than other positions.
So nature doesn't get going away?
I don't think so. I think nature just, well, this is something which actually we're just beginning to start, if I can get funding for it, we're just beginning to start some in vivo experiments where we ask that question, does nature care how fast something folds? Yes, so what I would argue is that the protein has to fold fast enough, and I wouldn't want to kind of put any money on what exact the point is, but then after that I don't think there's any evolutionary pressure for things to fold faster. Yes.
There is an argument that should be made, and that is that when you talk about the binding site, the counterpart is immutable. It is a substrate, or perhaps another protein, and you cannot play too many games. While if you talk about the core of a protein that is significant for the kinetics of folding, then there can be correlated mutations because everything is in the same protein. And these correlated mutations may still keep the rate at an effective high level, despite the fact that at each position you don't see conservation. And this is one thing that you can do with the money you're going to recruit. See if there is correlated mutations.
Well, in fact, we've begun to ask that on the next protein I'm going to talk about, where in fact we've got multiple mutations in the core. So I'll come back to that. I would argue that if you've got a protein-protein, you've got protein-protein interaction, then of course you can both sequences. Yeah, you've got co-evolution. So.
Is your expectation in doing the sequence conservation that the transition states for all those 200 different versions of this molecule have the same transition state?
Yes, because in fact what we're doing here is we're taking. We're looking actually at a family where there's relatively high sequence identity. Now, there's another question about if you take two proteins which have completely different sequences but the same structure, whether they fold through the same. And we're beginning to address that with the second system I want to talk about. And people have looked at that with other systems. And it appears that in the one system that people have really looked at in detail, that there seems to be some conservation, if you like, of the folding nuclei, even though the folding nuclei can be made up of completely different residues packed in a different way. But overall, the region that seems to be folding early is the same. This has been done by Jane Clark on immunoglobulin domains. In Cambridge. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So is the your definition of conservation has to do with amino acid identity, not amino acid type?
To be honest, I can't remember now whether Ewan did it with identity or type. Yeah, because obviously type, I think, is more appropriate.
So the question is, if you went to something which is far away as possible from your protein, then did the phi analysis on it, what are you predicting, that you're going to have a transition state in a different region of the protein, or is it going to be in the same region?
I would predict that for this protein, it'll be in the same region. But we can't do this with this protein, which is why we've now gone on to our other system, because in fact there aren't many examples of proteins with this structure which aren't quite closely related to this particular protein. So this is not a good system for addressing that question. Okay, so I just want to make the point that we see no correlation for this particular protein. So I'm only very, very briefly, because this work was done in collaboration with Valerie Daggett, and I want to concentrate today on experimental results, talk a little bit about some molecular dynamic simulations on the unfolding pathway of this protein and how well they agree with our experimental data. So Valerie did two high-temperature simulations at about 500 Kelvin, which are just shown here. Of course, one of our referees got very annoyed that the arrows went this way round, but of course the simulation is going from the folded structure to an unfolded structure. And we didn't change it, of course. And she identifies, using a particular technique which I can go into later if anybody's interested, a possible transition state for the unfolding of this particular protein. So of course under the same conditions, the transition state for unfolding should be the same as the transition state for folding. And here what I've done is shown the structure of those two transition states from her two different simulations and our phi value analysis. And you can see in the first simulation there has been a lot of loss of structure in the loop regions and also on the edge strands. The two, beta strand 4 and beta strand 5, are pretty much still in place. And the end terminus of the helix up here has already unraveled. So in the second simulation, there are some differences, but qualitatively, overall, it's quite similar. So again, in this case, there's not been so much unraveling of the N-terminal region of the helix, but there still has been a little bit of unraveling. And strands 4 and 5 are also still forming a lot of interactions. Again, loop regions, edge strands completely gone. So it would have been wonderful to have more than two simulations, and this is one point which I wanted to make, is that even at the quite low concentrations that we use experimentally, we're still measuring 10 to the 14 molecules. So what it would be nice to do was to have a lot more simulations rather than just two, to see how different the kind of structures in the transition state are between the different runs, and then begin to compare an average of those to what, of course, is an average which we're measuring experimentally. So I'd say that actually qualitatively, this simulation worked quite well, and it was done completely blind. We didn't give her any of the experimental data before she did it. And I think it's capturing the overall structure of the transition state that we're observing experimentally. Okay, so that's a summary, which I think I'll just skip. I think I'm going to skip this and get on to the second system. So within the protein database, there are a number of different structures which are very, very common. And these have been identified and classified by Janet Thornton and co-workers, and they're termed superfolds. Now, just because they're very prevalent in the protein database doesn't necessarily mean that they're very prevalent structures in the genome, because of course some structures may be much easier to crystallize than others. But in general, there are a large number of different proteins that are adopting these structures, and that in many cases there are a large number of proteins which are very, very different in sequence, which are adopting these same structures. So And these are termed superfolds by Janet Thornton. So of course we have the globin family here, immunoglobulin family here, this beta sandwich structure, which has been studied a great deal by Jane Clark in Cambridge. And we were interested, for a variety of reasons, at looking at two. So So when I first made up this slide, there were about 10 superfolds, and I'm not sure that whether that number's gone up or not. So we were interested in two members of these superfolds, one of which was the four helix up-down, four helical bundle structure here. And about a year and a half ago, we began quite a lot of work on this particular protein, which folds quite rapidly. But after about a year, we actually gave up the project, which was turning out to be experimentally unbelievably difficult because all the proteins that we were working with were aggregating. So I'm in fact not going to say, apart from the fact that this particular protein, the wild type, we have been able to measure the kinetics of folding, and it is very fast. And the two students who battled away for a year trying to do protein engineering and five-value analysis on this protein were very thankful when we finally made the decision that we were going to end this particular project. And what we've been doing recently, for a number of different reasons, is concentrating on a protein, a structure which structure called the UB role, or ubiquitin structure, of which there are a large number of examples in the database. And ubiquitin itself, remarkably, has already been one of the most highly studied proteins. And I think initially that was because you didn't have to make it yourself. You could call up your friendly Sigma chemical company and get them to send you bottles of the stuff. So, and remarkably, although it's been studied for probably upwards of 15 years, I'll go on to show you that actually there are still some very fundamentals about the kinetics of folding that are still quite controversial. So this is the overall fold. In some ways, it's quite similar to FKBP12. It's got a helix which packs against a beta sheet to form the core. So again, you have the N-terminus over here, and you have the first beta strand, which turns into a very tight hairpin, and then the helix. So you have a kind of N-terminal region of the protein defined by the beta hairpin packing against the helix. And then you have a couple of other beta strands. In fact, there's a fifth beta strand up here, which is very, very, very small. And for the purpose of this talk, we'll ignore that one. So we'll effectively say there are four beta strands. So we have one, two, three, and four. So that's just shown here. And as I said, there are a large number of different proteins which have this overall structure. And some of those proteins, are quite related to ubiquitin. So things like elongin B. So here what I've done is anything in red is actually a protein which we're studying, and anything in black are other proteins in that particular subset, which are related. So we've been studying ubiquitin itself, also elongin B, which shares some sequence homology with ubiquitin. But we're also looking at some proteins which adopt this overall topology and structure, which have no sequence homology at all to ubiquitin, including protein UBX, another protein called MOAD, which is actually a prokaryotic protein, not a eukaryotic protein, and then two other proteins, one of which is one from yeast, the other of which is APG12 from C. elegans. And what we want to do is begin to compare the folding of these different proteins. Okay, so this just shows you the structure of some of the proteins that we're looking at. So you can see that they all have the same overall topology, but there are some slight differences. In particular, MOAD, the prokaryotic protein which forms this ubiquitin-like structure, instead of having a tight hairpin here, it actually has the two strands are separated by a small helix, and that may be very significant in the folding. And again, there's an additional small helix here. So what we want to ask is whether this protein here actually folds in a similar manner to ubiquitin or elongin B and this. Okay, there's also there are a large number of these other proteins, some of which are quite interesting to study because they're related to various forms of cancer, and it's slightly easier to get funding to study them. So I just want to say a little bit about the folding of ubiquitin itself. So the folding of ubiquitin was done initially by Heinrich Roeder's lab at Fox Chase, and what I've done is shown his data here, which is again one of these chevron plots and shown in red. And there's some curvature in this plot and some rollover, which he attributed to the formation of some partially structured intermediate state. Well, very interestingly, in September last year, a paper came out by, from Tobin Sosnick's group, in which he'd reinvestigated the kinetics of folding of this protein, and his data is shown in black. And although the rates are quite similar, he sees absolutely no curvature whatsoever. So there's a bit of debate about whether ubiquitin is really folding in a two-state or a three-state manner. And both of those studies were done in the same conditions. And the difference was the way they fit their data. So of course we wanted to work on ubiquitin for a number of different reasons, so we thought, well, we better sort this one out so that we at least have a model to fit our data to. So we actually got a construct for ubiquitin, made our own ubiquitin, and this is our data here. Now you can see the unfolding rates are quite similar, and the folding rates slightly dissimilar. And the reason for this is that, and I think this illustrates a good point in terms of rate. The reason for this is that our construct has a tiny little tag at its end terminus. So instead of a positive charge at the end terminus, we have two extra amino acids. And I think that positive charge at the end terminus is quite important in the folding, so that we see a slightly reduced rate, because we don't have that positive charge there, but that actually we see no curvature whatsoever at pH 5, and we have the slope which is very similar to that observed by Heiner's group and Tobin's group. So we began to do this at a number of different pHs for a variety of reasons I won't go into, and our data is shown here. And again, I hope it's clear that the blue and the red lines fit perfectly to a two-state model. These are done at pH 5 and pH 7.4, but that at pH 2.2, this protein actually doesn't acid unfold, so you can look at the folding at pH 2.2. You do actually see now begin to see some curvature, but not much. No, it's still a single exponential, because effectively what you're doing is you're not observing the formation of the intermediate, because that's occurring within the dead time. So you're just looking at the rate of the intermediate going to the folded state. So you still see single exponential kinetics, unless you go to something like, you know, faster. I mean, these are all stop flow. I mean, what we want to do next is go to some faster techniques and do some maybe some temperature jump and some continuous flow. Okay, so we observe some slight curvature at pH 2.2, and we just wanted to convince ourselves that this was real. So we did a couple of things. There's no tryptophan in the wild type ubiquitin, and tryptophan is the main amino acid that gives rise to fluorescence in proteins, and is usually the signal that we use to follow folding. You can follow you can use tyrosine fluorescence, but it's much weaker. So a lot of people are using this particular mutant of ubiquitin in which a tryptophan residue, which is W, has been engineered in, so you just get a much better signal. And here we see some slight rollover for at pH 2.2 for this mutant, But because at pH 2.2 we can actually follow the folding using a intrinsic tyrosine fluorescence, we can also just look at the real wild-type sequence. And in fact, we see much more curvature in that case. And the wild-type is slightly more stable than the mutant. And again, there was an argument that actually one of the problems was fitting, and this was all to do with the fact that the rates were getting quite fast. And mixing artifacts. So we also just determined the unfolding kinetics at a lower temperature. So instead of at 25 degrees, at 8 degrees C, in which the rates are much lower. So we're not worried so much now about missing very fast phases within the dead time of the instrument. And you can see that we still get quite significant curvature. So we believe that, at least under some conditions, this protein actually does populate some partially folded intermediate state on the pathway. So what I've said is that at pH 5 and pH 7 we don't observe any rollover in the chevron plots, but we do at low pH. So that suggests that it's only at low pH that this partially structured intermediate state is stable enough to observe. So we have a kind of very simplified model based on some phi values and other evidence of how this protein folds. And I'm going to show you the model first. And essentially this model suggests that it's the N-terminal region of the protein that actually is folding first and therefore may be involved in this partially structured intermediate state. So this is the first beta hairpin and the alpha helix. So we said, well, what's different at pH 7 and pH 2.2? And the only thing that's different under those conditions is the charges on charged side chains. So here I've just illustrated the structure, and in red I've put the negatively charged groups, and in blue the positively charged groups at neutral pH. So what happens is, as we drop the pH down to 2.2, we begin to protonate these negative charges, leaving just the positive charges. And you'll have to believe me that there's actually, so this is the beta hairpin, and then this is quite a short loop around the alpha helix, and there's actually a cluster of negative charges in this area here. And what we think is happening is that actually at pH 5 or 7, that in our intermediate state, we're bringing together quite a number of these negative charges, which is repulsive, such that this intermediate state is effectively destabilized and not observed. And that at low pH is when we've protonated these negative charges, we now no longer have this unfavorable electrostatic interaction, so the intermediate is stabilized and therefore observed. So we just wanted to convince ourselves that this was what was going on. So we argued that... Oh, you mean the stabilities?
Yeah.
They're slightly lower at pH 2.2, but not much. It's actually, it's remarkably pH stable in both directions. So I don't think there are many side chains which have perturbed pKa's. So we argued that actually if this is what was happening, that we had an intermediate at neutral pH which was being destabilized by electrostatic repulsions, that if we somehow reduced the electrostatic repulsions at this pH, we would possibly stabilize this intermediate state and then observe it. And the simplest way of reducing the effect of these electrostatic interactions was to put in some salt to effectively screen them. So we argued that even at pH 5 and pH 7, if this is what was really happening, if we put in salt, then we should now get accumulation of an intermediate on the pathway and rollover. So this just shows you the data at pH 5. So this, the black is without salt, and the red is with salt, and hopefully you are convinced that there really is significant rollover under these conditions. And then pH 7, again, black is in the absence of salt, red is in the presence of salt, and again we start to see some rollover now. And there are other reasons why you might get rollover, and we've checked that, then, like transient aggregation, we've checked that that's not happening in this case. So, right, so we're now finally convinced that we kind of understand what's happening, and that this is a kind of three-state system, but this intermediate state is not very stable. It's very sensitive to the conditions. And we think that the reason why, if I go back a few, we think that the reason why at least Heinrich Roeder observes it at pH 5 and we don't observe it at pH 5 is that in our construct, in Heine's construct, he has a positive charge at the end terminus, which will presumably interact favorably with the negative charges beginning to cluster here. And the TAR construct, which has just two extra amino acids in, even though they're not structured, they effectively, now we've lost this positive charge, we've displaced this positive charge now further away. So we're not getting any favorable electrostatic interactions which would compensate for these unfavorable electrostatic interactions. So, now this is interesting, because you would think that actually, because essentially what we do is people frequently put little tiny N-terminal tags on proteins to be able to purify them easily. And then what you do is you can cleave off the tag, but you almost always leave like two extra amino acids there which aren't normally there in the sequence. Now, the thing about the structure of the thing about a lot of proteins is their last few N-terminal residues are quite frequently floppy and not involved in any structure. So it really wouldn't matter whether you had an extra couple of amino acids on there or not. But with ubiquitin, although it's a bit hard to see here, the N-terminal residue, which is methionine, actually its side chain points into the hydrophobic core and is part of the hydrophobic core. So here you have an N-terminus which is very close, if you like, to the main body of the protein. We think that's why we see an effect here, whereas in most other studies you wouldn't see an effect. So you could argue that actually ours with the extra two amino acids on is less biologically relevant. However, fortunately for us, ubiquitin isn't made as a single poly... It's made as a polyubiquitin chain. So there's multiple identical ubiquitins made, and then enzyme comes along and cleaves it up. So in fact, biologically, it's not got that N-terminal charge there, apart from obviously at the ubiquitin right at the end. Okay, so in fact the way we got into looking at ubiquitin, which wasn't an obvious thing to choose given how much previous work had been done on it, was the fact that we'd been looking at a library of mutants in the hydrophobic core of this protein, which had come through an in vitro selection procedure. So, essentially, without going into too many details, a library of proteins was made in which eight positions in the hydrophobic core, which are shown here in purple, had been mutated to many other hydrophobic amino acids. And in this case, these were the positions that had been mutated, and the amino acids that they'd been mutated to were phenylalanine, isoleucine, leucine, methionine, or valine. So you can, using molecular biology techniques, you can make these libraries, and then effectively what you can do is you can put on some selection or some screen and say, so here you have a library of five amino acids at eight positions, so it's something like 400,000 different possible sequences. And you can say how many of those sequences are stable, and also what sequences are stable and what sequences aren't. And this was being done by Deck Wolfson, who's based down in Brighton in the UK. And so he had a large library which he'd screened for stable multiple variants of the protein. What he wanted to do was for us to look at them kinetically and also look at their stability. So I wasn't initially going to include this, and then I had a conversation with Ken Bill on Tuesday, I think, when I mentioned these experiments. So I thought I'd just put in two overheads to talk about them. So I've kind of entitled this slide Exploring Sequence Folding Space. So what I would argue is we're exploring it, but experimentally it's much more difficult to explore it comprehensively than probably in simulation, because you have an upper limit on the size of these libraries. So here we have a library of about 400,000. If we now go and just even want to put in one other position, that library now goes up to something like 2 million, which experimentally begins to be too hard to handle. So, but we are exploring, I think, albeit a restricted section of sequence space, So we are exploring some of sequence space. So what we analyzed is a number of different mutants from this library, and that's just summarized here. And some of them have just a couple of mutations. Some of them are mutated in just about every single position in the library. And so these now really have quite a different sequence in the N-terminal hydrophobic core to the wild-type protein. So the question was what happens in terms of the kinetics? So in fact, all these proteins are less stable than wild-type by between 1 and 2 kilocal per mole. Some of them are overpacked in that if you take the average volume of side chains in the core, there are more than in the wild-type. And this particular multiple mutant is overpacked by about 5 methylene groups in the core. And some of them are neutral, so they have roughly the same core volumes, but now the absolute packing has changed. So if you like, I call them, they're repacked. They're not underpacked or overpacked, they're just packed in a different a different way. And then there are some underpacked ones where we have fewer methyl groups in the hydrophobic core. And remarkably, although you've actually made quite a number of significant mutations in the hydrophobic core, the unfolding and the folding kinetics haven't been changed that much.
What was the criterion for selection from the phage library? These are very few out of many.
Yes, it was stability.
So.
Judged by a protease, if you have an unfolded protein and you put in an enzyme which can cleave peptide bonds, then it will just cut up the protein into little bits.
Yeah,
they were immune to proteolysis.
Among the 400,000 different mutants explored, these are 6 or 7 best ones in terms of packing.
No. These are just the ones we analyzed. A lot more came out of the library. They probably sequenced, about 50 of them.
It's still a very small subspace of 400,000, and they are the best.
Yes, they're the only ones that come through they're the only ones that come through the screen. Yeah. I'm not sure. You get a lot of false positives doing this technique, I'm not quite sure in terms of percentage of the library. I'm not sure they've sequenced sufficient number that they know what percentage of the library they have that are stable. That's an interesting question. They do have ones where they're really quite a lot of mutations. So we looked at the unfolding and folding kinetics of these multiple mutants, and we find that actually all the mutants unfold faster than wild type, which is what you'd expect if you've destabilized the protein. And the range of unfolding rate constants is about 40-fold. But remarkably, even though some of these have quite different sequences to the wild type, they're actually folding with quite similar folding rate constants. So although perhaps we have quite different packing in the hydrophobic core, the exact packing is possibly not really that important in determining the folding. It's the fact that we've got hydrophobic interactions. And a very crude measure of the pathway called a beta-Tanford value, which essentially is a measure of the average solvent accessibility in the transition state, for most of these mutants is the same, apart from this very overpacked mutant, which has got quite a different solvent exposure and actually shows some kind of anti-Hammond behavior. Okay, so those were quite interesting in one respect, but what we really wanted to do again was get some site-specific information. So it's not possible analyzing that particular set of multiple mutants to get meaningful phi values out because you're changing so many different interactions at the same time. So we've begun to do some protein engineering studies on ubiquitin, and we don't have as many phi values as we have for FKBP12 yet, and this hasn't come out very well. So you'll just have to believe me that when we do the phi value analysis, that what we see is that we see that, in fact, there's a big difference between the phi values we get in the N-terminal region of the protein compared to the C-terminal region of the protein, and that the C-terminal region is, in fact, very unstructured in the transition state, whereas the C-terminus, there's definitely some partial structure formation. And I don't want to say too much because I always like to have at least 25 values before I begin to put a picture together, but it does seem to be quite consistent. Again, this is the C-terminal part of the hydrophobic core, this is the N-terminal part of the hydrophobic core, and we definitely seem to have many more interactions formed in the N-terminal region than the C-terminal region. Okay, there's a lot of information on this slide, and I'm just going to say one or two things very briefly. So again, we can begin to ask the same kind of questions with ubiquitin as we did with FKBP12, and in this case, there is residual structure. There is residual structure in the unfolded state, and there's also structure in states which have various strange solvents. And the structure seems largely to be in this N-terminal region with the first beta hairpin and the alpha helix, which in this case is the region which we see is formed early. So the point I want to make is that you can take one protein C residual structure in the unfolded state, which may be very important in determining folding, but you can take another protein and see quite the opposite, and that not every single protein behaves the same way, and there is some kind of structural and context dependence. And then again, I'm not going to go into details, but Valerie Daggett's group did some high-temperature simulations of the unfolding of ubiquitin. And again, qualitatively, this seems to be in agreement. Okay, I'm probably not going to say much about protein L, protein G, and ubiquitin. Anybody who's interested can come and talk to me later. We've now begun to look at the kinetics of folding of these other proteins that we're studying, including UBX and MOAD. So the folding of UBX is a little different because it's got a cisproline in the native state, so that complicates the folding. But you'll just have to believe me that this is why you don't see a perfect V. But this is actually linear, this part. So we don't believe that under these conditions there's an intermediate populated for UBX. Again, MOAD, much more simple. pH 6.825, we have no evidence for a populated intermediate state. And this kind of just summarizes the data that we've got on ubiquitin and also UBX and MOAD. And again, this is a kind of unfolding rates in water that you observe. These are the folding rates. Again, this is just to give you some feel for the kind of range of folding rates that we observe for proteins with very different sequences but the same structure. Again, this is three states. So what I've shown here is the value extrapolated from the two-state model, and then that actually measured in brackets. And roughly speaking, there's about an order of two orders of magnitude variation in the unfolding rate, and about two orders of magnitude in the folding rate as well. And what we want to do in the future is do some five-value analysis on not only on ubiquitin but also on these other proteins, which will really tell us whether they're folding in a similar manner. At the moment, we've only got a fairly crude measure, which again is this beta-Tanford value, which is essentially a measure of the average solvent accessible surface area in the transition state compared to the folded state. And in this case, it's actually very similar for all the proteins. So that's the end of the folding bit. I can probably do the last bit in about 5 minutes. 5 minutes is okay. Okay, so I said at the beginning we're actually not only interested in folding, but then what happens after folding, particularly what happens when you have large complexes formed in the cell in which the formation of those complexes isn't spontaneous, and we don't need that. And the protein that's involved in a lot of these proteins is a protein called HSP90. And there are a large number of examples now of assembly processes in the cell which absolutely require HSP90. And there's a whole range, and with the very different kind of proteins. So the protein complex formed between a protein called CDK4 and 6 and a protein called cyclin D, which are proteins very important in regulating the cell cycle and therefore in cancer. If you can actually make these two proteins alone, and you can mix these two proteins in a test tube, and they do not spontaneously assemble into a complex, despite the fact that the complex on its own is actually it's possible to obtain this from in vivo cultures. So this has now motivated a lot of people to actually begin to look at these processes. There are a large number of examples. So for steroid hormone receptors, the HSP90 is required in order to get the steroid ligand into the steroid hormone receptor. And again, there are examples where HSP90 is required to get a heme group into the protein. So we really wanted to know what was going on in these particular systems. So the structures, go back to that one. So most of the work that we've been focused on so far has been on the involvement of HSP90 in the folding and assembly of the steroid receptors. So this just shows you the structure of estrogen receptor with the bound estradiol. And HSP90 is absolutely required to maintain a high affinity binding site for this protein. So this is kind of a typical kind of biological slide where everything's a big blob. But essentially the steroid hormone receptor has to fold to some conformation in which it can bind hormone. And essentially, in the absence of HSP90 and some other proteins, it can't fold to a high affinity ligand binding site. So the question is what's going on in this case? Is the HSP90 required for the folding per se, or is the HSP90 actually required to fold and stabilize a very specific conformation of this protein. So without going through any details at all experimentally, is that we were able to take the steroid receptor, unfold it, and refold it in vitro, and begin to characterize the state that it folded into. So the first thing we found was actually that we could do this, which wasn't necessarily going to be the case. So we used the glucocorticoid receptor. We refolded it in vitro in the absence of the chaperone, and the state in which it folds to is actually quite, it's actually very compact. It's highly structured as far as we can tell. It's very helical. It's probably very similar to the structure that's been solved with bound ligand. It's quite stable, but actually it doesn't bind ligand with very high affinity. And that actually what the HSP90 is doing there is it's not helping in the folding of the protein per se, but what it's doing is helping the protein fold to a specific conformation in which it can bind ligand with high affinity. We haven't done that yet, no. You can refold it in the presence of ligand and get the ligand bound form. But I mean, what we're interested in is you can fold it in the presence of ligand and get to this form, which is the active form. But what we're really interested in is, what does it look like here, and why does it have to go round this whole fairly complex cycle involving lots of other proteins, involving lots of hydrolysis of ATP in order to get here? And the very interesting thing about these particular proteins is it's a very large family, and there's a subset of the family which is structurally very, very, very similar. The structures are superimposable, which don't require this very complex pathway and don't require HSP90. So what we're interested in is we think that what's determining the differences in these particular cases is actually the dynamics of the two proteins, not the structure per se. So what we're interested in doing is taking these two different systems and comparing what the dynamics are like. So I just wanted to include this because I think it's a very nice case where, although this protein can be folded to highly structured state, that's not the state that's biologically active, and that actually what has to happen is that you have to it has to be pulled away, if you like, from that particular state in order to be able to form its biologically active conformation. And
so,
what
you're talking about, control of folding, actually. And you're not, yeah, you're sure that it's not the end product, that it just changed conformation.
Yeah, well, what... Yeah, so that's the next question we want to address, is whether it folds and then it just binds to something which is perturbing its structure. Or whether, without going into too many details, if that was the case, and we're doing these experiments at the moment, we should be able to just take our in vitro refolded protein, stick in some HSP90, and get a high affinity ligand binding, right? But actually, in nature, what happens is that before it gets to HSP90, it's interacting with a lot of other proteins which are possibly keeping it unfolded. So there's a possibility that actually what we can do is we can fold to one state, but then once we've folded to that state, we can't then shift the structure over to another state, and that actually we have to fold directly to that state in the first place. Okay, I think I'm definitely going to finish there. I should just thank all the people in my group who are involved, who are all on this slide here, and then also my collaborators. So on the folding, Valerie Daggett in Seattle, David Wales in Cambridge, Deck Wolfson in Sussex. On the assembly, Ernest Lowy in Cambridge and Carol Robinson in Oxford.